All right, folks, I'm Sue. I feel like it's been a very bittersweet experience being back at back in Montreal. Nick and I chose to live here, and then we followed a job out to Fredericton. And I feel grateful to all of you for welcoming us here the first time, and then welcoming us back again now. So thank you for that. I also just wanted to say that this is a lovely reading for me because I get to read both with my husband, Nick, and with my editor on the book that I'm going to read from, Heaven's Thieves, who's Helen. So thanks to Helen. I almost feel like as I'm reading, there's like this little sly wink over in that direction. So I am mostly going to be reading from this book, Heaven's Thieves, and I'll read a couple of new ones as well. Yeah. Okay. Too far?
Yeah.
The last reading I did, I actually had to like crouch like this to get in the mic, which was not adjustable. So this is nothing. So the first poem that I want to read is a spring poem, which, you know, is the next best thing to actually having spring. It's also a poem about a spelling mistake. Somebody, I believe, intended to write the word gorgeous and ended up writing the word gorgeous. The poem is called Missing. Is that okay for the mic now? Yeah? Okay. Lauren is gorgeous. Scraped into the paint on a metal door near the high school. I don't know Lauren, but I believe it. Who isn't today? The trickling sounds of windblown meltwater everywhere, and every one of us missing a vowel. Ovid would have approved. This is how to chronicle beauty. Scratch it in. Show the something it takes from you that makes you ache a little, O avid one, most lovely vandal. And if your ode hints at gorgons, so much the better. We need their boldness to dare use words like shimmering, luminous. Droplets fall in sheaves from the gutters. The day's missing vowel expands in the sky all afternoon, giving off a light that dissolves in water the way Latin dissolves into all the modern Romance languages. Look up, gorgeous Lauren. The day awaits you. Some of you know that at the same time as I was writing most of the poems that made up this book, I was also doing work in philosophy on beauty. So beauty comes through the whole book, really. And it's front and center in this one, which is called The Invention of Beauty. The swan especially doesn't seem real anymore. So we ignore his arched neck, beckoning, inviting us to slip off the noose, asking us to swoon like we used to, as he glides undialectically along, dipping his sovereign head into the mirror and emerging again, unchanged, unfathomed, trailing past in invisible quotation marks, as if hundreds of versions of himself didn't float in his wake, a raft of platitudes. As if he were truly just a single swan swimming on a sunny summer's day. This next one has an epigraph from the Bible. The epigraph is, "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you were worried and upset about many things. So this comes from the biblical story of Martha and Mary, where Jesus comes over for a visit, and the two sisters, and Martha's a bit OCD, and she can't kind of settle down and relax and just be there with him. So this is this kind of gesture of, Martha, Martha, you're worried and upset about many things. Like, just relax, it's going to be okay. So the poem is called My Name. He said it twice. Martha, Martha. That made it easy. I understood. Listen, hear how his voice drops, deepens the second time. Martha. As though he were laying something down. Something he'd taken from me, which was too heavy for me. Too heavy for him as well. If a name spoken once is a claim, twice is the claim undone. Twice is love. They said he could walk on water. I believe that now. I wanted to speak his name, but hadn't the strength. That's why, since he left, I cannot go about my work. I stand in the kitchen reciting pairs of names. Fish, fish, fork, fork, stone, stone, spider, spider. Trying to match the timbre of my voice to his. So the thing named settles. So my troubles subside, and he too comes to rest. Lord, Lord. That is a very strange poem to read about the timbre of one's voice when in my peripheral vision here, there's this machine measuring the timbre of my voice. Here's another one, a shorter one, and also on a semi-religious theme. What can I tell you? I was hopeless on the playground, too quick to hold the hand of anyone who looked sad. It was the wrong thing to do, didn't help any of us. Yet I miss my childhood. What can I tell you? As I grow older, I begin to understand why there is a Christ on a cross. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to suffer that much, and I'm afraid. So going back to beauty now, one of the things that I read more than I may have liked to have read was Immanuel Kant's Analytic of the Beautiful when I was doing this dissertation on beauty. So it was very therapeutic to perform an erasure of Kant's Analytic of the Beautiful, which is, if you don't know, when you take a text and you kind of blot out the words that you don't want to use, and what's left is your poem. So I blotted out a great deal of Kant's Analytic of the Beautiful. So it's in super short sections, and each one represents a section of his work. So I'm just going to pause between these little pieces, and you'll know it's the erasure of the next section. So the title in the book is Kant's Analytic of the Beautiful, Fragments Thereof. My trouble was readily seen. I depend on beauty now. Above blame the green meadows. Aimlessly intertwined in each other, a common bodily pain. I, the rose, am confirmation. What it rests on will not be investigated here. In no way pathological, the beautiful strengthens itself when we linger. The botanists of paradise are beauties in themselves, are not pure, but we're not supposed to be. A fruitless satisfaction, deeply buried in all human beings. Incapable of beauty, someone has seen 1,000 grown men, illuminated, divided. My ideal? An object that could prove the possibility. And then his last section is general remark on the first section of the analytic, which is, there's my title. The shapes of animals, the song of a bird, a forest exactly imitated by a human being. The last one I'll read from the book is called The Dead. It's in three pieces, or three sections, and again, I'll just pause as we move from section to section. It's another beauty poem, eventually. This morning, the obdurate golden-green grass, blurred with dew, buried in the house's shadow. Deer, their faces softened by sleep, raise their heads and look through you, draining you of motive. You become as still as they are, waiting, as though under it all lurked another, more comprehensible world, carrying itself so slowly as to go unnoticed. What if the dead don't leave? Not exactly. What if instead they're what orients you? The sixth sense that turns you this way and that, tilts your face toward the light. What if they are the light? That would explain, wouldn't it, the strange clarity after someone dies. The peculiar radiance things acquire, even the least of them. Your loss everywhere transformed. Your suffering grown impersonal, self-sufficient. Each item buzzes with the vibrancy of the one who's gone, an inherited light that is no longer his or hers, that only you still recognize. So every time you close your eyes, something of that person leaves again. Let's be clear about the stillness you felt in the deer this morning. And yes, you're still staring, still feel the lukewarm glass against your forehead as you think of the dew and of the grass and of the deer themselves, now vanished from the lawn. It had nothing to do with the dead. The dead don't stop with their hearts in their throats. To die is not to wash through the body of a deer like a ghost. It isn't to skulk under a living skin. It's a change in the value of things. There's no such thing as the dead. When the dead die, they don't hold anything back. Otherwise, a bitterness, like the sediment in wine. It's pure alchemy. The world pours itself into the vessel of the new day, and the liquid runs clear. And that's what hurts, the clarity. It leaves you staring out the window, wondering what to forgive. The lawn more beautiful than it should be. The blades of grass all bent one way, silvered and utterly coherent, like a mirror with no face in it. I'm going to end with a couple of poems that are new-ish. These are the poems of pregnancy and early parenthood, just why there are a few of them. And I was trying in writing these to get at both the light and the dark of the experience, which is a really tricky thing to do because, of course, I don't want my daughter at some point to read these poems and feel bad for existing. So it's tricky. But on the other hand, you know, she may have to decide herself about whether she wants to have kids or not. And I think maybe it will be helpful to her to know that there is a dark and a light side, whatever way she decides to go on that decision. So, I don't know, two or three of these. The first one is service. I'm waiting for my life to change utterly. This will happen. My belly swells like a sail. The calm is involuntary. A navigational trick as we steer past the last buoy. I don't know who I'll be afterward. Distant twin, to whom all I'll have to give is who I am now. I wonder what use I'll be, how she'll put me to work, servant in the great house of her motherhood. I wonder what her child will know of me, and what thoughts I have now that will rise to run the bath, warm the room, then dim the light, sending them both to dreaming. I wonder what thoughts those thoughts will have then, standing by the window, wind gathering in the trees, what new selves they may devise as these strangers sleep. This next one talks about the Odyssey, and the last line is actually from the Odyssey. It's Odysseus speaking to Nausicaa, who you'll hear more about through the course of the poem. So he says, "I am at your knees, O queen, have pity." So that's where we're going to arrive here. Maybe that's the poem. I don't know. Maybe that's it. It's called Nostalgia, Longing for Home. Odysseus, the traveler who was trying to get home. Nostalgia. It wasn't so much the birth as the days that followed. Remember Odysseus before Nausicaa found him? Before he could scrape the scurf of brine from his shoulders? When he staggered from the river, unsteady of foot and uneasy of mind. It was like that, and it went on like that for some time. Lorazepam, bitter under the tongue. Nausicaa was sent to him by the gods, but he was afraid of the girls' voices he heard in the trees, and at first did not know how to speak. No more did I. Even if there were a word for what had happened, the salt had torn my voice from my throat. I pressed on. What choice? I too heard the voices in the trees, and like Odysseus, unclothed, crusted with dry spray, I finally spoke. I am at your knees, O queen, have pity. This last one I will read, is partly a love poem to my child, and it's partly it's part of a number of attempts I've been making to approach this one little passage from the Bible, which is, I haven't thought about how to explain this. It's both the title and the epigraph of this poem, as we were just talking about, but it's just the first two words of the title. So the first two words are all flesh, and then the rest of the epigraph is, all flesh is like the grass, and all its glory is like the flowers of the grass. So all flesh. I'm going to read it again, because you've got to absorb it to get what's going on in the poem. So the epigraph is, all flesh is like the grass, and all its glory is like the flowers of the grass. Surely not all flesh. Hers, for instance, seems as bright now as it must have been centuries ago. An ore endlessly raw, emergent, or so I can't help imagining. On all fours, she romps across the lawn, as though the grass has just now been invented, unrolled for her knees' pleasure. So entirely at home here, she doesn't seem like one of us. Must have come from someplace else, a soil more forgiving, a land where a gentler, suppler rubric prevails. How else explain her unravished joy in ravishing the dandelions, picking the seeds off the clocks, which emit only the faintest perfume of metaphor? For her, as far as I can see, what is done can simply be undone, like the buttons on her shirt. That is the substance of her flesh. And her glory? This, it's true, leaves almost no trace. Her path across the grass is like the rains, barely visible, vanishing, like the flowers, like the flesh.